Ever wonder what really happens behind the scenes in construction, real estate, and development? We pull back the curtain on the new home construction industry, the real estate market, and the trends shaping it all. Discover the stories, insights, and expertise behind the process of building a new home. Join us for Trust the Process podcast, and let's build something great together.
Welcome back to Trust the Process podcast, where we talk about new homes, the real estate industry, construction, and everything in between. Today, we are going to talk a little bit about walkability, and that's something that we have touched on a few times.
Yeah, it comes up
there, but I feel like it's come up enough times that it sort of warrants having its own episode.
Yeah.
So focusing on that, some of the zoning, which is how we've talked about it in the past, the subdivision stuff, kind of how that comes into play. And there's a lot, other countries that have more walkability. And so what that means.
Older cities,
East Coast has a lot of,
walkability
lifestyle. And some of that I think maybe came over with.
Probably. And, and because some of those cities predated the car, maybe. Yeah. And we, you know, now cities are built around the car, which is kind of at odds with walkability. If you think about what's good for the car is not good for the pedestrian in general. Right. Mm-hmm. And we've had a push pull in the last 100 years and the car won. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of that is not just legislation or this grand conspiracy by General Motors, even though they did buy all the streetcars in the Northeastern Seaboard, and between them and Bridgestone, the tire company, bought and shut down the streetcar lines. Little trivia. We only went back 100 years on that one. Usually we go back a lot farther.
Always going to get that little tidbit of history where we can.
Walking started about 2 million years ago. early man came from all fours. So that's how I look at it. As a developer, I think that the car and the pedestrian are at odds with each other. And although we do our best to try to do mixed use neighborhoods or make our suburbs walkable, you really need a few factors. You need the pedestrian to feel safe. You need density. And then you need a destination. So if you look at a walkability score, so Zillow and those third-party syndication sites have walkability scores, and you'll never really see a suburb with a walkability score higher than in the 70s. You usually go 0 to 100. And in fact, a lot of them are under 10 or under 15. And I don't exactly know what goes into the formula. I don't even know if it's public information. They just kind of come up with a walkability score. But the way I look at a Michael walkability score is, how is the density? So that is shorthand for what's the distances between here and where you're walking. People are only willing to walk, you know, maybe a mile, mile or two. You might start to see resistance at a 2 mile because then it's a 4 mile round trip. It's over an hour of walking. That's a lot of walking. That's a lot.
And so, there are times throughout the year where you just
in our city,
spend here and
it's
110.
Right.
And a mile long walk is tough at 2 p.m.
Yeah, exactly. Not good for your health. Yeah. So if you look at those things, and then you got to look at the safety of the pedestrian, and we talked about this in one of our other episodes where we were talking about a subdivision and street widths and minimums and, you know, sidewalks on both sides. So in one hand, the city is saying, put a sidewalk around your entire cul-de-sac, even though you're only 300 feet from the main road's cul-de-sac or the main street's cul-de-sac.
Right.
I mean, I'm sorry, the main street sidewalk. We want a sidewalk to go this extra 130 feet. It's really nothing. I mean, I don't even know how long it would take you to walk 130 feet. Probably under 30 seconds, right? So I get that. They're doing the walkability there. Great. The same breath, they're saying your street is too narrow. Mm-hmm. We're not going to give you a waiver. We want you to do a 47-foot wide, not a 33. Wide streets, scientifically, are less pedestrian-friendly from a psychological standpoint. When they pull pedestrians and their overall safety score of a certain route, its street width is a huge factor. And people don't even realize it. They just feel it. They say, well, I don't want to walk on this road. I don't want my kid riding his bike on this road. I don't like it. So you look at horizontal distance, i.e. street width, and then the vertical element. So if you're hemmed in by something tall next to you and a narrow street, that's the most pedestrian friendly. And then it goes out from there. The farther out, and there's actually a ratio on a YouTube channel called City Beautiful, and he's a really, really intelligent city planner. And he breaks it all down. I wish I could find the link. Maybe we can embed it. Okay. There's a kind of like a golden ratio. You want a certain amount of height. Okay. Now, at the same time, if you go to, you know, lower Manhattan or the financial district, sometimes the height is too much. So the height, you know, can be overwhelming depending on. But generally speaking, you're going to max out this quicker than you're going to max this out. People will tolerate walking next to 100-story office buildings more than they'll tolerate 400-foot wide boulevard. They're just not going to walk in Houston, let's say, these big wide boulevards, and they call them strodes. They're not streets, they're not roads. And they're, first of all, the horizontal plane is so wide, you don't feel comfortable. If you think evolutionary, ooh, we are going to go back to 2 million years. Evolutionarily, I think you're more alert. You feel like you're more on a prairie. Yep. There's more threats to you.
Yeah, right? There's more that could come up on you.
So that horizontal element. Then the kicker of this is, since the invention of the car, that horizontal element now involves 3,000-pound, 4,000-pound four-wheeled vehicles with people driving, texting, and going 35, 45 miles an hour, going faster because it's wider. You feel like you can. I mean, you just naturally do. You go down into old East Coast cities or in Europe, they have streets with trees between the street and the sidewalk, and then there's a 4 or 5 story building next to that. The drivers just drive slower. And then as many times there's cars parked on both sides, drive slower. Everything there is cueing the driver to slow down and therefore making the pedestrian feel safer. So if you look at those factors, so you can have
inadvertently cueing.
Exactly, right. It was a function of these were designed for horses and carriages, and now we're trying to fit cars on them. So what was a haphazard retrofit actually ended up to make some really great walkable cities. Then with that, with these roads and everything being narrower and different zoning laws or no zoning laws when many of these cities were built, you stacked. Everything was stacked, especially after Otis invented the elevator. More history. This one's full. All the ones of our previous episodes, I've been slipping a little bit. I think I'm trying to pack them all in here. And I did not think an episode on walkability would have so much history in it. But when Otis invented the elevator, we could start stacking up, and it became a status symbol to live on the top floors versus a status symbol to live, you know, on the ground level or the mezzanine level. Penthouse is kind of an invention of the 1870s onward. The Dakota apartment building in New York City was one of the first that had a penthouse, and it was planned around a square, and they kind of created a park space in the middle. And I don't know how tall the Dakota was. I think it was maybe in the 20s floors. And oddly enough, I think it was built in the late 1890s and through the 20s was kind of its heyday, the Gilded Age and all that in the roaring 20s. And that was a status symbol to leave your uptown townhouse and live in a high rise in a penthouse. So anyway, moral of the story is you had tall buildings that hemmed in your visual cues, and you didn't have minimum street widths because it just weren't designed. It was nobody didn't even conceive of it. It's probably designed to be a sidewalk, a market stall, and room for a horse. You know, in the original lower Manhattan and Philadelphia and Boston, that's kind of how they would have been laid out, and most of the cities in Europe laid out that way. So it was just a recipe to be walkable, because that is the default for civilization, was to walk to your destination. So it's no, what we're living in now is the abomination. What we're living in now is the abnormality, right? So we're trying to correct that. That's a push, I would say, from the 90s onward, maybe even later. This whole idea of mixed use, this whole idea of neighborhood centers.
You know, Green Valley Ranch has done it.
Green Valley Ranch, downtown. They tried.
Even the downtown, you know, that revitalization.
Yeah, and a lot of these
living above store.
And you know, hope. It doesn't catch because there's not enough. So what we've done here, it's been a commercial endeavor because it's easier to zone single use. So the commercial is generally highest and best use of a piece of land if it can do it, if it can sustain it. Commercial is a way better return on your investment for the same development costs, right? Because it is a rarer zoning classification, and you have to have the demand for it. So you have to have the traffic and the roads. So you get this commercial center, downtown Summerlin and parts of downtown revitalization districts nationwide, Tivoli, those kind of places. They're commercial centers first. They're not. There's not a residential component to it. Not particularly. So and that's because, and especially not first. Yeah. It's just so challenging to mix that use, and mix a residential building that has a commercial component to it. East Coast, you can find that all day long. They're all grandfathered in. It's really common back there. So without that mixture of uses, you don't have the destinations. So why would someone go drive, park their car, and then walk around the commercial center? They do it. We do it all the time, but it's not full walkability. There's still a car component to it. There's still offshoot parking and parking garages and things like that. Don't get me wrong. I still think that's a better iteration of a retail center than a shopping mall, in my opinion. Just my opinion. I think it feels, it breathes better. It lives better. it's not climatized, which is weird because you could argue that we started there and then went to malls because they're climatized, but people like outdoor shopping. So until we start mixing that, we're not going to see walkability in the suburbs. And you look all throughout the country, even in new development on the East Coast. DC is notorious. They have this outside, I think it's in Arlington or maybe even a suburb of Arlington. And they've tried to catch these multi-family mixed use. Florida's big on it. It just doesn't land. And it's not associated, oddly enough, with status. So I think that's part of it too. I think people see you aspire to be spread out. You aspire for low density. You start in an apartment, you end at a house. Maybe you circle back to a condo in your old age, right? But I feel that it's culturally too. You aspire to have a home on a half acre, a quarter acre. You aspire to have that. So we don't have that aspirational aspect of it on the mixed use, which until we do that, until we have a mixture of incomes, mixture of housing products, a mixture of uses, a mixture of intensities, you know, is this an intensely zoned retail center? Is it kind of just got some retail, like how you downtown Santa Barbara or something where you'd see, okay, there's a little shop or Sedona or something, pretty low impact, right?
Right.
But until we see that, I don't think we're going to see it. The market's going to have to want it before the political pressure is going to be there to allow it. So I think it's a chicken and egg.
Does zoning prohibit that or does it encourage? Is there any...
In our city and in most cities, you have to do an assemblage. So you have to get a big enough parcel. Usually it's around 25 acres. They have it declassified so you can have a planned unit development as small as 5 acres and then 10, when you're looking at commercial, it would be a neighborhood center and then a power center and then... You know, you kind of go up, there's actually cutoffs for the amount of parcel size. So until you get to mixed use, you really have got to get up to around that 25 to 50 acres. So now you're looking at a developer who can take that kind of project on, very capital intensive, and they're pulling in multiple specialties. So generally, you have one developer that's really great at developing office complexes, one that's really great at developing commercial, neighborhood centers, power centers, and then a residential developer that's pretty good, it's me, decently good, mediocre, at developing residential, maybe. So it's hard to get all those combined. I think that where it's worked really well, there's a couple examples in Florida where it's worked pretty well. One, maybe land developer, similar to how we have a master plan here.
Okay.
They'll develop the idea, the parks, the other amenities, and sell the individual parcels to home builders. So you'll see that. There's the one in DC I was mentioning. They bought the big acreage and sold to the office, the people that do offices really well, sold to commercial, and so on and so forth, and vetted those builders to say, okay, you're going to build our multifamily product. Ooh, Toll Brothers is really good at building luxury multifamily product. KB is good at building, and Lennar is good at building the entry-level multifamily product, and they kind of bring in that assortment of offerings and, mm-hmm. and capture and lean on that builder to have a financial incentive to say, we're going to brand this as an aspirational place to be. We're going to say you can aspire for a condo because it's a $2 million condo. It's very luxurious. You have amenities that you're not going to get in a single family home. So I think that we're getting there, and maybe the future is a mixture of everything like it has been. The last 20 years has been a mixture of everything, predominantly single family zoning.
But you do see apartments that surround, I'm thinking about Summerlin Center in specific. Mm-hmm. There are apartments nearby that you can
right.
live in that kind of give that. It's not necessarily in the center, but it's not purchase. It's not homes
right.
purchase. It's
right. So you don't have that community feel.
Yeah.
Right.
So you've got a very transient.
And again, people look at apartments as transient and you aspire sure. to be somewhere else. So you have to build an aspirational aspect of it. So, and I don't think necessarily that we have to do it. It's something I'm passionate about, but I live in the most non-walkable suburb that, you know, I could pick in an already pretty much unwalkable city. So look what I chose. I mean, it's fine. I mean, I'm not saying everyone should live like that. Mm-hmm. I just feel like it'd be neat if we saw more of it. And I think it would mm-hmm. lead to more vibrant cities. And also the city that takes up a lot less land. When you think about how mm-hmm. big Las Vegas could get, Phoenix could get, when if you zoned it, even with the missing middle that we talked about in the previous podcast, it doesn't all need to be zoned downtown. But what about that missing middle, that mid-rise, that 4 to 8 story, a lot of mixed use? You could fit a lot of amenities and a lot of people. And then, so let's say every morning I get up and go to Orange Theory, right? And that is a trip. But if I lived in a walkable area, I'd walk to it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you got a lot of people and you'd say, oh, what about traffic, traffic, traffic? Yeah, but some of my trips, if there was a grocery store, a lot of my trips would be walkable. And I would have our office, which is actually really close to my home. I have to drive there. I could walk it. I'd have to have to get out of my neighborhood, cross a major 4-lane road, then cross an 8-lane inner highway, mm-hmm. the 215.
Yeah.
And then a bunch of other 2-lane streets with signalized intersections and stop signs. So just, it's not possible. It's not. So I think about the amount of trips. My trips would be cut down 30, they'd be 30% of what they are. So I think that that would cut down on traffic and it'd be more sustainable. But we'll just see. I mean, we'll see what how the next generation wants to live.
It is interesting.
And that's going to dictate it.
Previous generations wanted to live that way.
Right.
Or, so it's
that was the norm for them.
It was.
That was all they knew. Yeah.
Maybe that's why they've gone away from it, because it feels
different. Again, it's aspirational. My parents did this. I aspire to do this. So I think that if you also look at back even just a few generations ago, my grandmother, still going, never rode a bike and never had a driver's license. So she lives in New York. She walks everywhere or takes the city bus, or my cousins bring her, my uncle brings her, and they all take care of her. So the idea of her living out in a suburb would just be anathema to everything that she's ever grown up thinking. It's just, no, I'm not, why would I do that? So it's as crazy as putting one of us in a, 4-4 walk up.
Yeah.
And just like
transportation.
And she gets on the bus. She's 92 years old. She gets on the bus.
Yeah.
Grandma,
it just doesn't happen much in Vegas. It doesn't happen here as much as it does in other cities.
Right.
And obviously over the years, they have done a lot.
They have. And I think a lot of suburban cities have. Phoenix has tried.
To try and increase the different routes and the,
make it quicker.
Nice, things are clean and it's pretty. But it still isn't people's go-to method for transport.
No, it's not. And then we weren't really ever laid out that way. So it's always going to be fitting a circle into a square, because I bet you, I've never done it, but I bet you to take a bus from anywhere around here to the center of town would be a 20-minute drive for me.
Yeah.
Probably a 2-hour bus ride. Multiple stops and transfers and you're stopping and...
Yeah.
I don't know when the express lane, I don't know how that works, but I just imagine it's not laid out like that. It was never designed to be that way. So passionate about walkability. I think a lot of our zoning laws are at odds with it. Minimum street widths. And you think about our little subdivisions and how an extra 10 feet of street adds, it really adds up and it makes a city sprawl. Minimum lot sizes, it makes it sprawl, and then sprawl breeds sprawl, because then more people need cars. So then more people want houses that accommodate cars and streets that accommodate cars and multi-generational living. And I love that when a builder will build a multi-generational 4,000 square foot house with a 2-car garage and a 2-car driveway.
Right.
Where are the people that are living in this 4,000 square foot home going to park their cars? Mm-hmm. Where are they going? Where is, if grandma's living with you, where is she going to park? So it just, I think it's going to be market driven.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be maybe an evolution, and it's going to take some public policy. It's also going to take some loaning, some changes in lending. So if you think about how challenging it is to get a condo loan versus a single family home, there's so many factors that are set up for the way that we're building and built to this day. So I don't think it'll be in my, I don't think I'll be building multifamily walkable communities. It's just not, it would take so long for the tides to change. And for people to actually want that, and for it to be marketable, and for it to pencil out.
Yeah, but it is an interesting topic, and a lot of people from other cities see it as a viable way to change things. And so you get asked, why aren't we building more of that?
Right.
Why don't we have some of that in our lives anymore? So
worth
mentioning and a good one. And like I said, it's come up in several of the podcast episodes that we've talked about. So we touch on it here and there, but so kind of diving into it a little bit further. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. It was fun to talk about.
Yes. And thank you guys for joining us. And we will see you next time on Trust the Process podcast. Bye-bye. Thanks for tuning into the Trust the Process podcast. Make sure to follow us on Spotify to stay in the loop with the latest insights, project updates, and everything in between. See you next time.